in honor of Yom Yerushalayim, somehow thematically, that whatever it is that we talk about this week should be connected to Yom Yerushalayim. So, I mean, it's not so nice to say, but Yerushalayim is never really directly mentioned in the Chumash. So in a class in Parsha, it's a little challenging to bring in Yerushalayim. In Sefer Devarim, there are a number of times that it speaks about HaMakom HaYishei Yivchar Hashem, the place that will become the chosen place, but it's a little bit premature. But we will work this in anyway because of a couple of issues, but let's begin and make a second observation. The reason why the request was made was because that this is the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, of the liberation of Yerushalayim, and therefore we chose the topic to be the significance of the number 50. So let's begin. This week we have two parshiot, Parshat Behar and Parshat Bechukotai. In order to appreciate the larger direction that the book of Vayikra has taken, so let's pay attention to a couple of things. One is that, and I believe I've said this a number of times, that really the proper name for Vayikra, or the proper content in Vayikra, is one of holiness, one of Kedusha. To limit it to Torat Kohanim, to laws that have to do with the Kohanim specifically, really sounds a little bit too limiting and doesn't cover everything, and for my mind does not cover many, maybe even most of the topics which are found in Vayikra. On the other hand, the concept of Kiddusha, of holiness, is something which is included. So you go from the very beginning, obviously, of the Korbanot, the Mishkan, the Korbanot. You move over to the story of Nadab and Avihu, and there you have going into too much Kiddusha. You then have Kedusha in terms of what you can eat, what you can't eat, in terms of food. You move over, or in terms of proximity to Kedusha, the laws of Tuma and Tahara. You move over from there into the Avoda of Yom Kippurim, which is the Kedusha Kadosh Kadoshim, going there to holiness in terms of relationships, in terms of the sexual relationships. In the second part of Parshat, going there, we have a Parsha called Parshat Kedoshim. I mean, it doesn't get more obvious in terms of Kedusha, with, again, certain things which are ben Adam l'makom, and right, where maybe we never would have thought of that as Kedusha, but no, that's part of Kedoshim to you. You have the interpersonal, you have the ritual, the man to God, again leading to another discussion of the Arayot, with other laws smattered in along the way, going in, and that takes us into Parshat Emor, which again goes back to Kohanim in terms of what the Kohanim need to do or avoid in order to retain the Kedusha, and what kind of animals you need to have in order to be used as something which is Kadosh and therefore is appropriate to bring as a Korban. And then it moves to holiness in terms of time, which is, or the holidays, and that was the second part of Emor. But the holiness in terms of time then has a very important aspect to it. And this goes perhaps to the very essence of a certain aspect of time. The Jewish calendar is a calendar which is both a lunar calendar and a solar calendar. So to avoid the confusion, we have lunar months, but we have solar years. And the solar years are, well, what I'll call solar modified years. And the reason for this is in order that the holidays, which are agricultural holidays, be connected to particular times of the year. So therefore, Pesach has to always come out in the spring. If you only had a lunar calendar, that would not happen, because the lunar calendar is slightly shorter than a solar calendar, and it would move by approximately 10 days a year, every day being earlier, and therefore it would creep into the winter, then creep into the fall, and creep into the summer, and go around like Ramadan does, which is a purely lunar month without any kind of a solar year connected to it. So when we have this agricultural aspect, which is revealed now, and as I said, it's another type of holiness, but it's a type of holiness which is connected to holiness of time, but it's also connected to holiness of space. The reason why I say connected to holiness of space, because now we suddenly have shifted the topic, and the topic now has become Eretz Yisrael. That has become the topic. I know that maybe it was very subtle and we didn't notice it along the way, but once we're talking about Ki Tavo El Haaretz, right, that should have been a hint, Ki Tavo El Haaretz, then these laws fall into place in their natural way, and the whole idea of the Omer is one which Ki Tavo El Haaretz. I know it's very funny because most kids who receive Jewish education will be under the impression that the Omer is what the Jews counted when they left Egypt. right? Leaving Egypt till you get to Har Sinai. And the Rambam says this, by the way, in the Moreh Nevuchim. So it's certainly an aspect of it to imagine, but that's not what it says in the Chumash. What the Chumash says is that when you come to the land, then you shall start counting the days between the Korban Omer, between Chag HaBikurim. These are agricultural posts, as it were, or demarcations. And the holidays now are specifically, again, if you want to look at what it is in Parshat Emor that makes it unique, it is the agricultural identity of these particular holidays. So then moving from that part of Emor and then going forward, we're not surprised at all when we get to this week's Parsha, which is now going to be Bahar and Bechukotai. So Bahar is going to be talking about the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, which again, clearly we've moved over to the agricultural laws, things having to do with the land of Israel, and so on. Moreover, the model of having 7 weeks, 49 days, counting to the 50th day, which is Matan Torah, and then having the model of counting the sabbatical years, and then 7 sabbatical years, getting to the 50th year, you realize it's the same model with the microcosm and the macrocosm. So therefore, in a certain sense, getting to Chag HaShavuot, as the Jews did in Sinai, but that's not really talking about Sinai, is it? It was really talking about getting to the 50th in terms of Chag HaBikurim. The macro of this is the counting the 49 years to getting to the 50th year. If you want to be a little bit sharper, in a certain sense, the 7 times 7 and then the 50th is really a Shabbat Shabbaton. Okay? The idea of Bikurim, of Shavuot, is really a Shabbat of the Shabbat. It's a Shabbat Shabbaton. The other Shabbat Shabbaton that we have, and by the way, the phrase is used, the other Shabbat Shabbaton we have is Yom Kippurim. So it's interesting that on what day do we blow the shofar on Yovel? We blow it on Yom Kippurim of the 50th year. What is Chag HaBikurim? So agriculturally, it's connected to the land of Israel. Theologically, it's connected to the day we receive the Torah. What's Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is the day we were forgiven and receive the second Luchot. So what exactly is Yovel? And where does Yovel fit into this? Yovel is this reset button. Everything goes back to its natural state, which then becomes very interesting in a certain sense. And what I'm about to say is true theologically, but will be hard to explain, so I won't, is that in a certain sense, man, from the day that he was created, back in Garden of Eden, had become defiled, in a sense, the way the Chazal put it, that the defiled from the serpent, as it were. But what happens at Har Sinai, then we shed the poison, the Zuhama, we shed the poison of the serpent, which means what happens? We've set the reset button, and we've gone all the way back to the beginning, which means Matan Torah itself was a reset button, and now we learn that Yovel is going to become the reset button. So again, I'm going to say that this model of the 7 times 7, 49 to the 50th, over here as well, the 50th is this concept of reset button, but the shift that is taking place is dramatic and is interesting. It's saying that land which will be divided to the Jewish people and to the various tribes and to the various people within the tribes, that land over 50 years can end up moving and shifting and people could need to sell and have to sell, but there's a reset button and things go back to the way they're supposed to go back to. So therefore, what God does in the Shemitah year is he reminds us, this is really my land. And by the way, the implication of it being my land, one is, and we've heard it a couple of times in Vayikra if we paid attention, this is a holy land. This is a land with a very delicate constitution. It will vomit out sinners, and that's the implication of holiness. If you want to feel a little bit better, Rav Avraham Azulai, who was a great Kabbalist, he once wrote, so therefore when you're in Israel, anybody who you see, you should realize is a tzaddik. Why? Because it's a pasuk in the Torah. And the Torah says, the land will vomit out anybody who's not a tzaddik. So anybody who you meet who lives in Israel is therefore, by definition, he says is thereby a tzaddik. This is very useful, and I don't know how often a day you may need to use this, but this is... Okay, so one thing is the land itself, we're told, can't tolerate behavior which is inappropriate. But it's more than that. There's also, in terms of ownership, God is saying, this is my land. I'm letting you be there, but this is my land. This is God's land. And if it's God's land, it's a place which has holiness. So every 7 years, when God says, okay, stop working. This is my land. Stop working. So even though we think we own it, God is saying, this is my land. So these things are interrelated because that's what gives it its holiness by virtue of the fact by it being God's land, and we therefore we need to behave in a particular way. When it comes to the Yovel, so then not only is it God's land, God is now reminding, but I gave it to certain people, and things need to be the way that it was given. So that pretty much took us through the first source, which was Perek Kaf Hei. And it's not, I don't have the whole thing over here, but v'shavta ha'aretz shabbat Hashem. Hashvi'it shabbat shabbaton yeh la'aretz shabbat la'Hashem. Shenat shabbaton. V'lehem techal l'chaya sheba'aretzecha tiyah kol tuva l'echo. By the way, it's interesting. Who eats Shemitah produce? So there's a couple different verses. The poor eat it. Over here, there's one says, you eat it. Animals can eat it. And I know that we get very nervous by Shemitah. I'm going to come back to that soon. V'safarta lecha sheva shabbatot shanim, sheva shanim, sheva pamim, v'yu lecha yimei sheva shabbatot shanim, teisha babim shana, v'avarta shofar trua b'chodesh hashvi basor lechodesh b'yom ha-kippurim, taviv shofar b'chol artzachem, v'kidashtem et shnat ha-chamishim shana ukratem dror ba'aretz lechol yoshver yovel hi. V'shavtem isha l'chuzato v'isha mishpachot hashuvu yovel hi shnat ha-chamishim shana, and so on. So this idea of the 50th is when things turn back and goes back to the reset and its natural sense, the way it was supposed to be from the very beginning. So that's really the significance of the yovel, or in English, the jubilee. It made it onto the Liberty Bell, although don't take these things so seriously. I mean, on the wall of the UN, it can have verses from Isaiah. A man who lived in Jerusalem, a Jew who lived in Jerusalem, and somehow the same building can deny that there was Jews in Jerusalem at the point that it says on the very building. I mean, I would think they should probably erase what it says outside, but who am I to make such value judgments? And it ends up, look at, for that Kaf Gimel, Va'aretz Lothim Kalit Smitud Ki Li Ha'aretz. God is saying, this is my land. And it ends up in Nundalele, V'lo Yigel Ba'ela, V'yatsu B'shnat Yovel, sorry, Nunhei, Ki Li B'nei Yisrael Avadim, which means the land is my land, these people are my people, the land goes back to the people. And again, this is this wonderful interrelationship, but again, don't lose focus. What's the main focus? The main focus is one of Kedusha. The main focus is one of holiness. Of course, the flip side of all this is going to be what I didn't bring here, because that's a little depressing, and that's Parshat Bechukotai. And Parshat Bechukotai is, if you don't remember the holiness, and if you don't live by these standards, then I will kick you out. And the main focus there is the agriculture, is the idea of Shemitah. The number 7 comes up again and again in Bechukotai, and it says it clearly, if you don't keep the sabbatical year, you'll kick out, and then the land is going to get the rest that it needs. You could decide if this is something agricultural or something which is spiritual. Chazal understand that there were 70 years exile between the first and second temple to make up for the 70 Shemitot over the 490 years that the first temple stood. So it's not that it needed to rest 70 years in a row, but there's a spiritual, clearly a spiritual component to this. Now, there are three aspects that I want to identify, and then we're going to see how they're connected. I'm going to go a little bit more into halakha than I normally go to in a parsha class, but you'll bear with me, or you'll get up and leave. And if you get up and leave, you can do it and make a lot of noise on the way out. You can slam the door. I mean, yeah, I mean, drama is always good. So there are three aspects. One aspect is the basic Shemitah aspect, the sabbatical year, which was already mentioned back in Mishpatim. And here we have a much longer and in-depth treatment of Shemitah. What was added now was the idea of Yovel, which means the shift has been between just a 7-year system, 6 years works and then the rest, which by the way sounds very much like Shabbat, 6 days you work, seventh you rest, sixth, whatever. Now we're added, another aspect was added, that was the Yovel, and that's really the main addition to this section, aside from other details that were put in, but it's the one that we suddenly have this realization that there's a larger system. Again, when it comes specifically to Shabbat, there's not a larger system. Since creation of the world, 6 days, every seventh day has been Shabbat. That's non-negotiable, there's no fixing it, that's what it is. When it comes to Yovel, now we realize, oh, this is part of a larger system, and let's pause there for a second. The third aspect is an aspect which we will not see till Sefer Dvarim, and that's going to be called Shmitat Ksafim. And Shmitat Ksafim means that if you gave out loans in the seventh year, those loans are automatically canceled and one should not ask for the loans to be returned. Source number 2, Miketz Sheva Shanim Taseh Shmitah, V'zeh Dvar Shmitah Shemot, Kol Bal Masheh Yado Asher Yasheh B'Reyehu, Lo Yigos Et Reyehu V'et Achiv, Ki Kara Shmitah L'Hashem. If you lend money, don't go asking for your money back, because it's Shmitah. et nachritigos. If you want to ask anybody for their money back, then do it to non-Jews. Now this obviously, right, could be misunderstood. But when it comes to your brothers, then you have to practice Shemitah. Now this is a very strange application of Shemitah. So let me explain it, and then we're going to maybe look into one or two commentaries who will say it. Can we think logically for a second? I know that's unusual, but let's try to think logically and rationally. Who has money and who doesn't have money during the sabbatical year? Farmers will have less money than they normally have because they can't sell their produce. People who are not farmers will have more money than they normally have because they don't have to pay for the produce because they're taking it all for free. So who's going to be asking to borrow money? The farmers will be asked to borrow the money because they have a problem with liquidity because they have not been working. And on the other hand, the other people who have regular jobs will have less expenses during the Shemitah year because everything is for free for them. So therefore, they have excess money. So where did that money go? That money is going to be lent. Now this is very interesting. So God says, okay, but don't ask for the money back. So now what just now happened? You just now paid for all your Shemitah products. Now, we don't sell Shemitah products. You're not supposed to sell it. So do you realize now what this law of Shemitah Kesafim did? It is social justice in the sense that again, you can't sell Shemitah products because it's holy. But let's make you all partners in this, and therefore the haves and the have-nots will end up sharing. Whoever knows economics can make up a term in order to describe what this is. But that's what Shemitah Kesafim... That's what Shemitat Kesafim is. That's how it works. And that's the logic behind it. You look at the Chizkuni for a moment in source 3. Aval bishar shanim adam zoreya v'kotzer v'im hamalveh dochako omer lo hamtein li ad shem korit tvoti. In the normal years, a farmer borrows money, so the guy's going to say, wait, I'm going to sell my produce and give it to you. Ki kara shmita, ki paga zeh shmita, lo shon mikre kodesh. What's going to happen now, he's not going to have it. Continue. Et nachri... Why did it say you can, from the non-Jew you can ask for your money back? Because the non-Jew is working during Shemitah. I know it could have sounded very racist, this whole law. He said, no, this is a very practical law. The Jew doesn't have money, so therefore you become a partner in the keeping of the Shemitah by lending him money and not asking for back. On the other hand, the person who doesn't keep Shemitah, so then you can lend him money and you do ask him for that money back. That's exactly the way the Chizkuni understood it. But then he adds something, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. Mikan omru hilul hazaken, et achicha tishma yedcha, v'lo hamoser shtarotav lebeitin. When it comes to your brother, you don't ask for the money back. But if the contracts were given over to the court, then you can ask for it back. Because it's not from your brother, it's from the court. But what's interesting about the Chizkuni here, he just understood that as being a din d'oraita, a Torah law. Torah law is you don't ask your brother for your money back, but once your brother gave the money over to the court, it's no longer your brother's. It's no longer your brother. Now it's the court. So then you can't ask for it back. That's on a Torah level. And then he adds, "Mikan amr hilal zakein it can prusbul b'netikin olam shirata olam shenu nuumi lavot zed zevarvu al mashakatov b'Torah." And based on this, Hillel established the concept of prusbul. Now I'm going to pause here, but the main point that I want you to see is that he understood that this is something which is based upon a Torah law. Hold on for this for a second. Source number 4, the Bechor Shor, v'sheyelecha et achicha, prat l'mosesh taratav lebeitin. So he has the exact same limud, the exact same learning of the verses like the Chizkuni did, that from your brother you shouldn't ask for it back, but if it was given over the court, oh, that's fine. She'ein lo alachu klum elo lebeitin. Uprat l'mal v'sheyesh lo mashkan. It also comes to exclude anybody who lent money where there was collateral. She'ein lo b'yad achiv klum. She'yesh lo mashkon. V'af lo karinen lo yigos, aval et anachri tigos. She'anachri zorei v'kotzer, v'otzer, v'yichol l'shalem l'froa. Aval achicha lo charash v'zera v'lo kotzer v'me yishalem. How is he going to pay? K'kor achich shmita l'sodotav l'ashem, l'shem shemayim v'ein lo b'may yifara. He's not going to be able to pay. By the way, I would comment on this. It's not that, yes, he didn't plant, but things that did grow by themselves. Again, on a Torah level, there's no such thing as svichim, which is a rabbinic law that things that grew by themselves you shouldn't eat, because then they'll claim that they'll plant and claim they didn't grow by themselves. But on a Torah law, things that grew in the trees, that's 100% fine. Things that grew in the field by itself would be 100% fine. Those things he can't sell. So over here, it comes back to the same point. The non-Jew can plant, and therefore the non-Jew you can ask for the money back. The Jew has not been working. How can he ask for his money back? And I'm going to say it again. That seems to be the deeper point. But I want to come back to Hillel. But the reason I want to come back to Hillel is, first of all, we just now met Hillel. But the reason I want to come back to Hillel is it's going to take us back to Yovel. Which means Yovel is our objective over here, but we're going to enter into a discussion about Hillel. So let me just say a word about this thing called Prusbel first. Rabbis should never be lenient. Never be lenient. Because whenever we're lenient, people use it against us. They're always cynical. Whenever you're lenient, they hold it against you. By the way, when you're strict, they hold it against you also. But at least they respect you. They totally lose respect for rabbis when rabbis are lenient. I'm just letting you all know this. I'm on to you. I know the truth. You're all masochists anyway. And okay. So if a rabbi is lenient and says, oh yeah, you can sell your chametz, people get cynical about it. You can sell the land of Israel, people get more cynical about it. You could put a string around the, you know, then you can carry. Anytime we come up with a heter for anything, then people, it breeds cynicism. And then there are people who will take this even further. Maybe they'll even, they'll say, you know, when it really comes down to it, rabbis can do anything, right? If I wanted to, I could declare pork kosher, right? I can do that. And the only reason I don't do that is because I don't like any of you. And I think that, did I just say something crazy? I know I did, but I see people all the time, they write silly things saying, well, if the rabbis wanted to, they would allow this. What are you talking about? And the most cynical formulation of this is when there is a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. Now, that happens not to be true. At least in my opinion, that happens not to be true. There are many, many things in halacha that we cannot do and we cannot change. And sorry, I apologize. We're actually, and I really never should admit this, if I kick me out of the union, I don't pay any dues, so it's okay. But no, we cannot do everything. There are limits. There is actually laws. There are times that we can come with great creativity, but it doesn't mean that every single situation has a solution. Not every situation has a solution. So I just want to say it straight off. But when Hillel was lenient, he has caused rabbis till this very day. It's actually, most of those rabbis are not necessarily Orthodox, by the way. I think I mentioned this once. I was once convinced to be at a panel discussion in Tel Aviv where there was somebody representing secularists, somebody representing reform, and somebody representing conservative, and I was there representing Orthodoxy, which I know sounds pretty pathetic. A friend of mine actually agreed to do it. He went and had a stroke, which I thought was a great deal of chutzpah, from the hospital. From the hospital, his wife calls me, will you please go? And I was supposed to say, no. He should have refuah shleimah. He goes, no. So fine, I went. And lo and behold, it seems that all of them had conspired, and all of them were on the same side, and it was against me. It was actually against all of us, but you didn't realize it at the time. And one after the other got up and said, Judaism has become fossilized. I mean, after a while, we are conventional, because they were talking about fossils. And they said, no, but the truth is that, you know, the rabbis don't do what they can do, because we can change things. And Prusbel kept coming up. Oh, when the rabbis want to, they can change whatever they want. To which I responded, I said, let's take one example. And from the 1950s, the conservative movement decided that you're allowed to drive to shul on Shabbos. So I said, I'm not even going to be cynical and say that most conservative Jews today drive any place other than shul. I'm not even going to say that. But of course I said that. I said, what is the implication of saying you can drive to shul on Shabbos? The implication is that you can live further from the shul out of walking distance. And once you're in the car, does it make a difference if it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or 20 minutes? Doesn't make a difference. So therefore, by allowing people to drive to shul on Shabbos, they destroy Jewish neighborhoods and Jewish communities, because people can live now further and further away from a community, and therefore Jews don't live in communities anymore, and they go to school with other kids who are not Jewish. So basically, by allowing Jews to drive to shul on Shabbos, you cause there to be intermarriage. That's what you caused. You caused there to be incredible intermarriage throughout the community, because there's no more communities anymore. Because Jews now live isolated in the suburbs away from other Jews. Let's get back to Prusbel. Because Prusbel kept coming up, look, when the rabbis want, they can change the Torah. So now this is only slightly true. And that's why I want to take a minute or two and explain really how Prusbel works. So in order to do that, let's take a look in source number 5. To do this properly, we would need to learn the whole 10th chapter of Shvi'it, which talks about Shmitat Ksafim. Shmita mishametet etam milva, bishtar velo bishtar. Shmita cancels loans, whether they're written in a contract or not. Hakafata chanut, ain't a mishametet. When you go to the makolet and say, I'm taking this milk, write it down, It does not cancel that. That's not a loan. That is a debt that you have because you're supposed to pay the person, but you said, I'm not going to pay you today, I'm going to pay you next week. So writing down is not considered a loan. But if you said to the store owner, instead of write it down, if you said to him, can you lend me this money? And he says, okay, then it's a loan. So you have to be very careful. We have to teach, or not teach, the makolet owners what they, you know, what they should say. They still do this. I check. They still do this. They do it. No. In Yerushalayim as well. I checked this recently. It is still done. It's only you who have become quite sophisticated. Sachar sachir eino mishamet. If you owe wages to your worker, Shemitah does not cancel. That's a debt. It does not cancel that. V'masol milva. But again, if you say to the worker, oh, can you lend me this money that I owe you? Then it just became a loan. So again, the principle is, Shemitah cancels loans. It doesn't cancel other kinds of monetary obligations. Ha'onis of mefatev emotzi shemra. So here are different laws in the Torah where we're told that a person does something wrong, they have to pay a fine, a knas from the Torah. So what happens? V'chol ma'aseh beitin, and anything which is part of a legal act where the court declares this money needs to be paid, eino mishamtin. All legal actions are not cancelled by Shemitah. Hamal ve'ala mashkon, if you lend money and there's collateral, that's not a normal loan. That's a different kind of a business deal when there's a collateral there, which means, here, give me $10,000, you hold on to my car. I'm not giving $10,000 back, fine, I'll keep the car. You can say, it's Shemitah, I cancel. Yeah, cancel everything, but I'm keeping the car anyway. So Ana Mashkon is not a regular loan, so it doesn't cancel it. And if also, if you took all of your contracts and you brought them to court, it doesn't cancel. Now that's what we saw a number of the Rishonim say. That's a Torah law. Because it says when your brother has a loan, it gets cancelled, but not when it's in the court. And all of these things that we just now saw are all Torah law. Now what exactly did Hillel do? Hillel said that if I sign a contract, a prusbul, I can sign a prusbul saying, I am hereby declaring that all loans that I'm going to be giving this year, I am giving them over to the court. So the big thing that Hillel did is instead of actually having to bring them to the court, he said it's enough to write a contract that I'm hereby giving them over to the court. And he says, okay, that doesn't work. Now, did he just now break a Torah law or not break a Torah law? Because I can make an argument and say, what did Hillel really do? He just extended the law which is already here and said it's no longer achicha, it's no longer your individual loan, now it's something which belongs to the court. So the Gemara questions this in source number 6, being that it's Masechet Shvi'it, the only Gemara we have is the Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi writes, Prusbul einu mishamet. This is one of the things that Hillel did. When he saw that people were no longer lending money. And by not lending money, they were breaking on what it said in the Torah. And what was it said in the Torah? Do not hold back and lend money. Why lend money? Because people are not going to have money that year. You have money, lend money. And so on. Hitkin Hillel Prusbul. Zegufu Shel Prusbul. This is the Prusbul. What is it? Moser ni lachem ish ploni uplonu hadayanim shav makom ploni shakol chol sheyesh lishagvenu kol zman sheir. It's hadayanim chotvim lamata oedim. So either a court signs it, or the witness is signed that you have given this over to the court. Now the Gemara questions this. Mikan samchu leprusbul shu min haTorah. Goes, you know, based upon, you know, the verses that I already showed you is what Hillel was basing himself on when he created Prusbul, which sounds like it's a Torah law. And by the way, I can agree with that. Yeah, Prusbul's a Torah law. It fits into something which already exists. So again, did he really break the Torah or not? But let's continue. Kishehitkin Hillel samchul dvar Torah amar Rav Chuna kashiyata kume Rav Yaakov bar Achov kimanda amar ma'asrot min haTorah. Because this whole question comes up according to the opinion that says the ma'aser is still a Torah law. Now you notice I just put the word still. The Hillel matkin al davar Torah. Now the Gemara just now shifted. But did Hillel really do this to circumvent a Torah law? Rabbi Yossi v'chimisha shagalu Yisrael lebavel lo niftiru min amitzol tatloyot ba'aretz? Isn't it true that when the Jews first went into exile, by the way, this would already be the tribes on the other side of the Jordan, when the Jews went into exile, didn't that then cancel the mitzvot tliot ba'aretz? It says Vashmei Ksafim Noeg Ben Ba'aretz Ben B'chutz La'aretz Dvar Torah Chazur B'Yosef Amr Zed Dvar Hashmita Shemot. Why is the dual language Shmita and Shemot? Bisha Shashmita Noheg Dvar Torah Hashmei Ksafim Noheg Ben Ba'aretz Ben B'chutz La'aretz Dvar Torah. When Shemitah is a Torah law in Israel, then Shemitat Ksafim is in Israel and out of Israel. Uvishasha Shemitah Nohegim in Divrehem, but when Shemitah is only a rabbinic law, Heshmei Ksafim Nohegit Ben Ba'aretz Ben Dechutz La'aretz Mi Divrehem on a rabbinic level. Taman Amrinan, they said in Bavel, Afilu Kimanda Amma Ma'asrot Var Torah, even if you're going to say that Ma'aser is still a Torah law. Now, this I just want to warn you, not all of the mitzvot hatzluyot ba'aretz, not all of the agricultural laws are necessarily the same, and it contends, even if you argue that for whatever the reason is, the ma'aser is a Torah law, mode b'shmita shehim divrehim. Shmita is different. Ditani, as we learned, v'zeh dvar ha-shmita shemot. Rebbe Omer, shnei shmita nalalu. There's two shmitot. Shmita v'yovel. Now we finally got back to Yovel. That's why we went here. Shmita is linked with Yovel. And by the way, of course Shmita is linked with Yovel. That's the whole purpose of Parshat Bahar, to tell you that Shmita is linked with Yovel. Bishasha ha-Yovel noheg, Shmita noheg et min ha-Torah. That as long as there's still a Yovel, then Shmita still applies on the Torah level. Paskul ha-Yovelot, but when Yovel stops, Shmita noheg et midvrehim. That Shmita becomes rabbinic. Eimatai paskul Yovelot, but when did Yovel end? Yoshveha, it says for all of those who live, all of the people who live in the land, Yoshveha. V'kidashtem et shmat tachamishim shenat ukratim dro ba'aretz, the whole Yoshveha, to all of its inhabitants. Bizman sheyoshveha aleha, lo bizman shagolu mitocha. Not when the Jews were exiled. And by the way, what does exiled mean? Hayu aleha aval hayu me'orevavin. If the Jews were in the land of Israel, but they were mixed up, meaning Shevet Yehuda b'Binyamin v'Shevet Binyamin b'Yehuda, Yachol Yehayovelot Nogelin. Is it possible then that Yovel applies? Talmud Lomar Yoshveha. L'kol Yoshveh Nimtzet Omer Kevin Shagolu Shevet Ruvin v'Gad v'Chatzi Shevet Menashe Butlu Hayovelot. The conclusion of this Gemara is, of the Yerushalmi, is that as soon as the 2.5 tribes were carried off, there's no more Yovel. Because Yovel is a law when all of the Jews are in their proper place and each tribe is in their proper place. Needless to say, today we don't have all 12 tribes in each and every one in their proper place. According to what we just now learned, not only, therefore, is Yovel no longer applicable, also Shmita is no longer applicable, and by extension, also Shmitat Ksafim is no longer applicable, which was the point over here. Please recognize now that what it was that Hillel did. On a Torah law, I lend Stu money. Want it the other way around? Or you like it this way? Okay, I lend Stu money, right? Shmita comes along, and he says, sorry, you know, Shmita. So now, he has my money. On a Torah level, whose money is this? On a Torah level, I lend him money. On a Torah level, whose money is this? No, it's mine. Because Shmita is Rabbanan. I lent you money. I'm not going to... Very, very simple. Very, very simple. I'll say this again. I lend you money. I'll be clearer. Today, Shemitah's Rabbanan. 2 years ago, during Shemitah, I lend you, how much you want? I lend him, no, not enough. Enough that, I lend you $100,000. Shemitah comes along, and says, sorry. You know, it's Shemitah. So on a Torah level, whose money? And the rabbi said, don't ask for it back. On a Torah level, it's my money. Because Torah level, it's not Shemitah. So when Hillel says, okay, let's make a prizbul, so now you can get your money back, so is Hillel defending the Torah law, or is he going against the Torah law? Of course he's defending the Torah law. So to use prizbul as the example of the rabbis can go against the Torah is a little funny. They're not. If it's really what prizbul is doing, it's going back and it's protecting the Torah law. Hillel, at least what we just now read, but the Rambam reads it the same way. What we just now read is that Hillel doesn't go against the Torah law. A matter of fact, the money is really mine on a Torah level. On a rabbinic level, he says, don't ask for it back, right? So, okay, make a prizba, which I'm going to go back and say again. It sounds very much, if you read all the Mishnayot over here, I will admit most people don't do, because it's much easier. First of all, the whole prizba thing is mentioned in the Gemara in Gittin, which is out of context and just saying, oh, this is one of the things that Hillel did. But if you actually read in context, you understand that there was this limud that if it's a court action, it's no longer applies under the Shemitah Ksafim law. So all that Hillel did is, okay, let's make a contract that this becomes owned by the court. So I can even say that what Hillel did is the Torah law. It's not that he went against the Torah law. It is the Torah law. So it's pretty funny how Hillel gets misrepresented, but let's leave that for a second. And by the way, the other issue that he brought up is that people are not going to loan money. Now, loaning money is a Torah law. Loaning money to take is a Torah. So therefore, people, because of a concern for rabbinic law, won't keep a Torah law, and on a Torah level, it is mine, and the procedure that he uses is really according to the Torah, as we saw before. So to use this as the examples that rabbis can do anything they want, I think is a little unfortunate. Source number 7 is when this is quoted in the Gemara in the Bavli. Hillel hitzkin prizbol b'nei tikkun olam. Hillel created prizbol in order to make the world a better place. The Gemara here goes in, it goes, v'avru masha katuv b'torah. Again, the same thing, it quotes the Mishnah, that people were going against what it says in the Torah, because you're supposed to lend money. We're skipping down a little bit. And then the Gemara, and there's the Bavli as well, says, umi ika mide diraita mishamet shviyit. Today, in today's world, in the third line where it's underlined, is today Shemitah really on a Torah level? The Hitzkin Hillel de lo mishamtan. Hillel really said, went against the Torah? Amar Abaye b'shvid b'zman hazeh v'rebihi. It goes according to a well-known opinion, which is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who, by the way, admittedly lives after Hillel. But they say, no, Hillel was of the same opinion, which was articulated as well by Rebbe. D'tanya, Rebbe Omer, v'zeh devar shmita shmot, b'shtei shmita ta'katuv medaber, echad shmita karka, v'echad shmita ksafim. B'zman she tamishamed karka, tamishamed ksafim. B'zman she iya tamishamed karka, iya tamishamed ksafim. That means that when the Shemitah of the land doesn't apply, which Rebbe understood did not apply already during Second Temple period and onward, so it says then there's no Shviit of a Ksafim either. And it goes back to the same point. Rashi over here in source number 9 connects it back to our Yerushalmi. Rashi 9 says, "B'shviyat b'zman hazeh, v'hilo ki Rebbe sfirilei de Amar." We'll skip a little. Milva b'zman hazeh, d'rabbanan hu. V'yafagam v'hilo b'bayit sheni, hava sfirilei labayit b'bayit sheni, ho v'loya yovel nohig, lo nagu shmiti d'raita. So it goes back to the point of yovel. There was no yovel at that point. There's no yovel, therefore there's no shmita. There's no shmita. There's no shmitat ksafim. That means what Rebbe did is he didn't go against the Torah law. All that Rebbe did was going against the rabbinic enactment to have shmitat ksafim during this time. Right? And he writes, umatsati b'talmidei Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi shakatav mesechet gittin b'Yerushalmi. So it's funny. This is one of the many instances that shows that Rashi did not have a Yerushalmi, because he quotes somebody who saw that there was Yerushalmi. Masha ina shmita heged ela bizman sheyovo noheg. Shemar zed var shmita shemot. Right? Shmita yovo vachet shmita shviyit. Okay, and then he mentions that maybe another opinion in the Torah Konim. So let's go on achshav shebat l'kdusha ta'aretz, which Rashi says in numerous places, that in terms of the agricultural laws, I don't want you to misunderstand me, and I'm going to have to come back to that before I finish, that in terms of the agricultural laws, what is Rashi saying? That Israel has lost its holiness. That doesn't mean Israel's not holy. It doesn't mean you don't have a mitzvah for living here. You do, and you do. But rather, he's saying that regarding the Torah level of certain agricultural laws, they don't apply because they have certain criteria, certain condition. A condition of Yovel we already saw, liyoshveh, l'kol yoshveh, that everybody has to be in the land. Everyone has to be in their proper place. The Gemara in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi does the same thing with the linking of the Shemitah and the Yovel, and we're not going to read it here. You'll just know that it's there in front of you, that it does the same thing. Bizman shekol yoshveh alev, lo bizman shegol mitzotan, yachol yu alev ayum orvim shevet bin yamin biyuda v'shevet yuda bin yamin yeinoeg. So the same thing we just saw in the Yerushalmi, it's here in the Bavli as well. So just in case you will be convinced, oh, that's some unknown opinion. No, we have the Bavli saying the same thing in the Gemara in Erech and in source number 10. So here will be a little part of the shocking thing, and then I'm going to be able to hopefully come back, because part of my problem is I have far too many sources over here. So what I'm going to do is I want to get up to your question. So what about Shemitah today? And then for that matter, the Heter Mechira, which I will, in passing, I will show you why it's not even necessary. You like that? Forget about being good, about not even being necessary. First, the Shulchan Aruch. What did the Shulchan Aruch do with all of this? So you say, well, where would the Shulchan Aruch speak about Shemitah? Well, it does. In source number 12, which is the laws of loans, Hilchot Hovah, Choshimishpot, Ein Shemitat Kasev Nohegit Minat Torah, Elib Isman Sheyovel Noheg. Okay, there you go. That Yerushalmi, that Bavli, that which we saw, that Shemitah and Yovel. So now, going back, in our parsha, what do we learn about Yovel? What's the significance of Yovel? Yovel is things go back to its natural state. If you don't have Yovel, you're not in your natural state. That's part of what I want you to understand. What does it mean you're not in your natural state? So none of the laws just can't apply. If Yovel doesn't apply, you can't have Shemitah, because it's all about everything going back and people being in their right place, and then things fall in line. If you don't have Yovel, then things are missing. So here we have that's written in the Shulchan Aruch, which may have been somewhat surprising to you. We'll skip a little bit to the third line. So let me remind you something. Theoretically, let's say that Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is Drabanan, which I think was the way to, well, on a rabbinic level, I think that was the way to understand most of what we've seen. If Shemitah is Drabanan in Israel during the seventh year, then Shemitat Ksafim is all over the world in the seventh year. Shemitat Ksafim is not limited to the land of Israel. Shemitat Ksafim is all over the world. By the way, go back to my point, those who work and don't work, oh, you're going to live in Englewood? Great, you've got to support the people in Israel who are the farmers. Absolute Torah law, what I just now said. Not just Englewood. Also Tinek Shenishba, even Muncie and so on. Hendon. Let me then continue. So the problem is that during the Middle Ages, nobody was writing a Puzzle. During the Middle Ages, the Jews just sort of forgot about Shemitah Ksafim. Totally forgot about it. And that's part of what the Ramah tries to deal with. Now, let me just give you a little bit more background, and then we'll be able to make a little more sense. There are those who will somehow disagree with everything that I showed you so far today and say, no, Shemitah today is still D'oraita. It's still a Torah law. There are those who will say that Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is D'Rabbanan. There are those who will go even more lenient and say it's not even D'Rabbanan, that Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is a Minhag. Or less than a Minhag, it's a Midat Chasidut. It's a nice, pious thing to do, but there's no obligation. So I'm saying every opinion you can think of, there's somebody who will make such an opinion. But over here, it says there are some who say that it doesn't apply today. And we'll skip a little bit after the Rush, Tam Minog, the Maharik. Uvecheshbon Shnat Hashmita Nafla Machloket. And we have an argument regarding what year is the Shemitah year. I want to stop a second right there. You may be thinking right now, how in the world can you have a machloket what year Shemitah is? I found a long, long discussion. One of the few Rishonim who actually lived in Israel had a hard time. You know, what exactly do we do? And he wrote a long, long piece about this, quoting every single opinion. And it's complicated. Part of the complication is, do you count the 50th year? And then the 51st is the next one, or is the 50 the first? Just how you count already starts the problem. But I'm going to say it again. There are multiple opinions about how Yovel is counted and how Shemitah is counted with the Yovel, which led him to that line. So we have an argument with Shemitah. Now, does anybody understand principles of halacha? Oversimplify this, and then you can all be rabbis after this. Be completely comfortable to decide anything in halacha. You ready? If something's a Torah law, you have to be careful, right? Safek deraita l'chumra. If something's a rabbinic law, then you can be lenient, because safek derabanan l'kula. Right, I did oversimplify it a little bit, but if Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is Drabanan, and then I have a suffix whether it's even which year is Shemitah, then I have a suffix on a Drabanan. Suffix Drabanan is the Kula. That's exactly what it just now said in the Shulchan Aruch. When the Avnei Nezer, one of the great Hasidic thinkers, rabbis, poskim, was questioned about the Heter Mechira, he plays around with this without even needing the Heter Mechira. He said, no, Safek Drabanan Lekula over here. And he, by the way, in the argument, he builds up three or four different sfeikot that he has. First of all, maybe the law is like the Sefer Trumot, who said Shemitah isn't even Drabanan. And right, maybe we don't know, and maybe this, and maybe that. And he goes into all kinds of things over here, why you don't even need there to be a heter mechira because bisman ezeh shmita is rabbanon. We don't even know what year it is. But this is not the reason I'm quoting this. Is this is not some random opinion? You realize who that was? That was the Ramah. Right? This is, you know, really one of the most dominant opinions regarding what halacha is for Ashkenazim bisman hazeh. And a secret, the Sfaradim Amor Mekel, but not right now. Along the way over here, in source 16, the Vilna Gaon, on the bottom of where it's bolded, Avol Yesh Omrim Hu Arazah Shekatuv Dafka Bizman Sheyovel Noheg Midrabanan Sheyovel Vishmita Kasher Shein Nefrad Hu V'Hayu Nogin Yovel Achabat Lubeitin V'Chulei Because of the Shmita Tzarech Gamkin Kiddush Beitin. According to this opinion, you can't have Shmita without Yovel because you need the court to declare that it's a Shmita year. So the fact that we have an argument which your Shemitah is actually a symptom according to the Vilna Gaon. But you needed a court to declare it. Without the court declaring it, you cannot have a real Shemitah. Going a little bit lower in the Vilna Gaon. In 17, he quotes the Sefer HaTrumot, who says it's not even, right, it's only a custom. And the last, in source 17, so let me explain what in the world he's talking about, and we will have to, after this, somehow move towards, back to our conclusion. In 18, the Gemara, the Mishnah says, it talks about people who cannot be kosher witnesses. One of the people who's mentioned over here are people who do business with Shviyat, Sochrei Shviyat. The Mishnah says, Omer Mishimon B'tchila you Korinotan Osvei Shviyat. Originally called them those who gather Shemitah material, Mishirabu Ha'anasin, but once there were people, no, it's not clear what the Anasin means over here, people who were tough, people who forced them, then they Chazu L'Kotem Sochrei Shviyat. Then they call them people who dealt with Shviyat in terms of monetarily. The Gemara in source 19, Maininhu, what in the world was the mission talking about? So it says, Arnona. Anybody know that word? It says, what's the problem? Arnona. Hidemachru is Rabbi Yanai. Is Rabbi Yanai says, so what's Arnona? Arnona was, look at Rashi at the bottom of 22nd line from the bottom, Mas Shagova Hamelech Minatvod. It's a tax that the king used to take based upon a person's field. Back to the Gemara in 19. Kidemachm is Rav Yanai. Once the tax came on the Jews, Rav Yanai says, Puku, go to your fields, Vizorah b'Shviyat, go and plant on Shviyat. Mishum Arnona, because there's taxes. At that point, they changed it from people, Osfin, to Sochrin. That you're allowed to work on the sabbatical year because, now this is very funny. This is very funny. I know, again, all of us are rabbis today. We already decided that. We all know something. In the case of Pikuach Nefesh, where life is in danger, you're allowed to break Shabbat. So was this a case of life being in danger? It didn't quite say that. It actually said, it said the problem was paying taxes. It's not a question of life being in danger. Tosfot, in his second opinion, goes in that direction. Rashi and Tosfot, in his first opinion, don't. Say, how in the world could Rav Yanai get up and say, go work on Shviyat? So look at Rashi in source 20, but after the word Anona, at the end of the line, Puku Zaru B'Shviyat, Shviyat B'Zman Ezeh D'Rabbanan, D'Bat L'Kedushat Haaretz. Why? Because Shviyat is D'Rabbanan. And basically what Rashi is saying over here, and their other posts will go the same way, V'Mokom Tzar Lo Gazru. In a difficult situation, Mokom Hefsid Lo Gazru. Why can you work on Shviyat? So when the whole Shviyat controversy came in the more than 100 years ago, 120, 130 years ago, some rabbis went and did make this Heter Mechira, which, by the way, is based on Sephardic opinions which were over 300 years old. And the Sephardic rabbis were allowing it left and right. That's why I said that for them there was no question over here. Some of the Ashkenazic rabbis said, so what are you talking about? You don't need Shviyat Rabbanim Bizman Hazeh. The new farmers, the people who came to Israel, they're under duress. Okay, so let's find a way. I mean, I don't need a Heter Mechira. You don't have to go that far. By the way, on top of all that, the Heter Mechira today is better than it ever was for multiple reasons. The person they sold it to this past time was somebody who came from a Jewish family. He wasn't Jewish, from a Jewish family, who served in the army, kept Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, and he was from one of the Russian Olim, whose father was Jewish, and I believe his kids are Jewish, but he's not Jewish. He's the one who bought the land today. Wasn't selling it to some, because they said, how can you go and sell it to somebody who is, you don't really believe that you can sell it to such a person without going into more detail than that. And they also took it to the Ministry of Justice, and the contracts would have stood up in a court of law, which was not always the case before. The Hetta Mechira today is better than it has ever been. But what I try to show you right now, once you realize, you don't need a Hetta Mechira, based on what we just now read in Rashi, and there are a number of Achronim who went in the same direction. There is nothing as contentious as reading the Tshuvot and the back and forths on Shemitah, and I will tell you a little hint about all of this, as they said in Wardegate, follow the money. That's all that I'll say. Follow the money. That's all that I'll say. Shemitah was always a great opportunity to raise money, and especially when you had whole communities that were only living on donations in the first place, the fact that you'd have Jews working the land was actually quite threatening. Let's just stop it at that. And by the way, the OU said that they're going to put this on their website. I just want to say, I want to make the following statement so they can cut this part out. So I'll warn them. You can, and that is that all the kashrut organizations, including the OU, all over the world, do not allow the Hetta Mechira, and they boycott Israeli products. And should I use that word again? They boycott Israeli products. They set warnings. Oh, Israeli peppers were seen in this store. Do not buy these. When the BDS is boycotting Israel, and for Orthodox Jews to join in on the boycott, you have to realize that there's something fundamentally wrong about this. Rabbi Soloveitchik said more than once, I heard him say this, that anti-Semites have a great radar when it comes to holiness. If you want to know what's holy, check what bothers anti-Semites. Right? Brit Milah, right? Europe, Shechita in Europe, Israeli products, and so now you know these are the things that are important. But during the time that they're boycotting, it's Shat HaShmad, and I say, I don't understand how you can possibly say, okay, we can't use it. If Shemitah is Drabanan, and by the way, I'll tell you another secret. There are barely any Jews working, actually, with their hands, with the products themselves during Shemitah. There are barely any Jews working and farming it anyway, and anymore. So that also could make a very, very big difference. So over here, it's like, you read the Gemara, and you say, look, what are you talking about? So I will pause at that, but I want to get back to Yerushalayim. So after everything that we've read, so now we perhaps will have reason to believe that, okay, Israel is no longer holy, Israel has lost its holiness, and there's no more, but I want to stress that's in terms of Shemitah. And again, if you look later on, you look at source number 20, you look at source 23, Rav Avadia, who predictably will be very, very lenient. Okay, source 24 is in Bichukotai. And in Bichukotai, we learn about losing the land, right? This is what I also pointed out, and all the times that Sheva and Shabtoteha, Az Tirtza Aretz, Shabtoteha, Pasuk Lamed Daled, Az Tishbota Aretz, Viritzer Shabtoteha. So you see it's multiple times it comes back to this point. And then Pasuk Lamed Heikil, Yimei HaShema, Tishbota Teshevta, and so on. But Az, Viritzer Aretz, Shabtoteha. Okay. Let's read, look at Pasuk Lamed Aleph for 1 second. V'natati et areichem chorva, v'ashimoti et mikdoshechem. I'm going to cause your cities to become desolate. I will destroy your holy places. Now look at the Rambam in source number, verse 25 and then 26. 25 is where the Rambam talking in the laws of Shemitah V'Yovel, and I told you before, the Rambam follows what we had already had seen. Mishagal shevet Reuven v'shevet Gad v'chatzi shevet Menashe batlu hayovalot. Without reading all the things, halacha tet, uvizman sheyovel noheg, when there is no noheg shviyat ba'aretz. Afterwards, but when we don't have yovel, noheg shviyat ba'aretz midivrehim. Then it only applies midivrehim, v'chein hashmat k'safim b'kol makom midivrehim. So basically everything we saw is in that Rambam, source 26, the Rambam in the laws of Beit Bechira. V'lamani oma b'mikdash Yerushalayim shekdusha rishona kidsha la'atid lavo uv'kdusha shara Eretz Yisrael inyan shviyat u'ma'asor k'yotzim lo kidsha la'atid lavo. The Ram says that when the Jews entered the land the first time, it was given holiness. When they left, it lost the holiness. When they came in the second time, it got holiness. But the Rambam says we need to be careful. Why do I make a distinction b'mikdash Yerushalayim that even the first kedusha was forever? That was never canceled. The Kedusha of Yerushalayim never was canceled. But the rest of Eretz Yisrael, regarding Shvi'it u'ma'asrot, lo kitshula tidlavo, that got canceled when the Jews left. L'fi shekedusha tamikdash Yerushalayim mipnei ha-shechina. V'ashechina eina b'teila. And the Shechina can never be canceled. V'arehu omer v'ashimoti et mikdoshechem. As it says, quoting from our parasha, Bichokotai, I will make your holy places desolate. I will make your holy places desolate. That means that desolate, but they're still your holy places. Which means Yerushalayim never loses the Kedushah. So Eretz Yisrael can lose the Kedusha regarding Shvi'it. I want to go backwards now. Why does it lose Kedusha regarding Shvi'it? Because Shvi'it is part of a much larger agricultural system which has within it a couple of different components. It has the whole component of the finances that we spoke about, that people who have money should be lending people who don't have money to pay for it, but it's also part of this larger Yovel system where everybody's in their proper place and the land returns to them. Which means that part of Yovel means that land will have to return to the people, but now we're in a situation that the people aren't here, so the land can't return to the people, so therefore Yovel doesn't apply, so Shemitah doesn't apply in a Torah level, Shemitah Kesafim doesn't apply in a Torah level, but Yerushalayim never lost its holiness. For the very first time that the Shekhinah settled on Har HaBayit, that never was lost. And he goes, that's based upon the Pasuk, also in Parashat Pechukotai. I want to end with one last thought. What troubled me with the Parsha is that the very end of Perikavav, which is the Tochacha, which speaks about all the terrible things that are going to happen, the concluding pasuk there is, Eila chukim v'mishpatim v'torot, asher natan Hashem beino v'in b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai b'yad Moshe. Okay, that's a great end. And then we have another parak. Why is there another parak there? And the other parak talks about the laws of Erechin and the laws of Tmura. And when you make a vow about a person's value, you have to bring that korban, and so on. Then it ends, Eila ha-mitzvot ha-shetzivah Hashem et Moshe o-bnei Yisrael b'har Sinai. So, totally anticlimactic, I mean, no offense. I mean, it just doesn't work. Why is it here? So I want to make a suggestion. And my suggestion is based upon what I think is the most important pasuk over here. But let me just, it's going to be pasuk yud, but let me hold on for a second, and then I need to explain. What we're told is, remember the whole introduction today? It's holiness. Where does the holiness begin? Actually, it actually began all the way back in Perek Yutet. All the way back in Perek Yutet of Shemot. The Jews stood at Har Sinai, and God said, you are a holy people. Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh. We said, Manaseh v'Nishma, the Aseret HaDibrot, we received the Torah, Parshat Mishpatim, going through, I'm not going to go all of Shemot now as well, going all the way now to the end of Vayikra, realizing this is the end of that beginning. It starts over there, you're holy, but now we learn the price of holiness. The land can't take non-holiness, it will get you out, and God says, I'm going to kick you out. Now what happens when we get kicked out? So we get kicked out, there are going to be nations, we can look, if you want to point a finger at Christianity, you want to point a finger at Islam, who will adopt what we can call replacement theology. They will say that the fact that God kicked the Jews out means that the Jews have been replaced. God rejected the Jews. They were kicked out. So they're going to read the same things. The Jews are kicked out. That's it. It's over. So now we learn in this extra parsha, anticlimactic, having nothing to do with anything, we learn one more thing, which I think is essential. It says, ואם בהמה שיקריב ממנו קורבן להשם כל שתין ממנו להשם יהיה קודש, לא יחליפנו. Once something was declared holy, it can't be exchanged. ולא ימיר אותו. You can't switch it for anything else. טוב ורע רב וטוב. There's a law which is called Tmura. The law which is called Tmura means that replacement theology doesn't work. That once God declares something holy, it remains holy forever. The law is regarding us in terms of, you should know, again, why is this here? If you take this animal and say this animal is holy, you can't switch it for another animal. So I'm going to go so far as to say that if this is the law based in Shamata, this is how God tells us we need to behave, this is also a law in terms of based in Shamala. This is also telling us how God behaves. And once the land of Israel is declared holy, it's holy. The Shekhinah cannot be Mevatel. Yes, there are technicalities regarding the laws of Yovel or Shemitah and so on, that may not apply in certain places. Those are technicalities. Living in Israel is still a mitzvah because it is still a holy land. The Shekhinah is still here. That never gets canceled. And just in case the nations of the world think that the fact that we didn't behave and got kicked out, therefore replacement theology, we were replaced, what does the halacha say? No, it doesn't work that way. This is a melechet kohanim, v'gai kadosh. Holiness remains forever.